right, guys, take your Bibles, if you would, please, this morning, and turn to Matthew chapter 28 for a moment. We'll get started with that rather well-known passage, and we'll pray. What's going on here? Screen. Matthew 28. There's obviously a very well-known text here.
Last passage here in Matthew 28:18, it says, "Then Jesus came near and said to them, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe everything I have commanded you, and remember, I am with you always to the end of the age." Let me pray for us, and then we'll dive in. Father, thank you for the privilege to be able to share some thoughts this morning regarding world evangelization. Trust that you will speak more through me and through your word, even through some of these pictures we'll show today. It might be an encouragement to these men. Now, Father, we pray that you be the one to receive all the glory. Thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. What I'm going to do today is, with my great technical skills, I actually looked up some old pictures that I had and figured out, by fooling around for a while, figured out this little section at the bottom just had a picture of a spam. And so I figured, maybe you can email these. And so I filled around and I sent them to Alex. And so hopefully these will show up on the screen. I'm going to walk you through just some things that I think some of you have probably seen. Is this working? Okay. So what are you working on? Am I to do it? Oh, okay, it's over here. The very first trip that I ever took was in Bolivia. And we visited a group of missionaries, about five families, on a little river way, way out. We flew into an area. And the reason I show this right off is that we were looking for the Yuki Indian, a nomadic tribe of group of people who just travel through the jungle. They never stay more than about one night in a place. They bring their fire with them. They carry it with them. They have no clothes at all. We went looking for them. We found a place that they had tied a knot around a tree. And that was the first sign we realized that didn't just grow like that. You know, that was a knot. We never did actually find them, but we kept looking for them. They took me fishing one day, and I caught a 33-pound sunabi, which is what you do is you go out and you first of all you catch piranha, then you put the piranha on a clothesline with a huge deep sea hook, and you put gloves on and you just throw it out there. You have no pole. And then you wait till the line goes out and you set the hook and you pull that thing in. And that thing when we got in there, we couldn't kill it until we finally got a machete and finally got it through its head and ended up feeding all of our camp that night. That was me holding the fish, yeah. Did you do what?
Sorry.
What was the question? That was me. But that was 28 years ago. Oh, that was 29 years ago, actually. That is not me. That's the leader of the team there. We're back in the jungle. We took a rifle with him just in case we came across some wild animals and stuff. His name is Wally Pouncey. And these guys were really great missionaries. They'd really gone back into some difficult areas. I'm sitting next to a plane getting ready to fly out. The interesting thing about the Andes Mountains is that as you're flying, one side is desert, and it's almost like a razor blade where you can see where the jungle begins. And it's just solid jungle from there on. That's a friend of mine. We're sleeping on a hardwood floor way back in the boonies. We flew in. It's a single-engine plane. You landed way, way back. I might even have a shot. Here's what an airstrip looks like in the jungle. You're just out there in just nowhere. These are real old pictures. It's not all the high def stuff we have today, but it gives you an idea. You're just looking for this airstrip, and you just hope these guys can find it, and of course they did. We landed, went into a little village. You know, you talk about keeping your house clean. This is how people live. If you look into the house, you see this red stuff hanging out. Those are the entrails of some animal, and there's no refrigeration. Anything stuff just hangs out there, lives out there. But I'm traveling with two other guys. I'm not sure that the guy in the foreground here in the white shirt is still alive. His name is Paul Rill. And Nick Sanford in the background on the left is was the guy that got my brother involved in world missions, and a dear friend passed away of a brain tumor about 13, 14 years ago. I did his funeral. So lady we met back there getting her dinner ready. Anybody want to eat? We have some bagels back there. This is how probably 2.5 billion people in this world live, somewhere in that vicinity. Many, many people. Never heard the gospel, know nothing about the things of life at all. That's how they live. Even the fact she has those kind of clothes are people that we or clothes that we bring in to these people. So this is a very, very difficult situation. I'm getting some water from my toothbrush, pouring down rain. Rains all the time. The most difficult thing we had on this particular trip was we had flown into the jungle. We were supposed to stay about 3 or 4 days. And the difficulty is that it kept raining and raining. We couldn't get the plane out because the runway was just so wet and sloppy. We'd get out there during the day with cups and literally clean out the runway and pour water into buckets, carried away. And then you'd hear in the middle of the night, just like a train going through the jungle. Rain is pouring down and we couldn't get out. So they eventually had to take us out by boat. This is a little picture of us walking through the jungle where you see these huge trickles that come out of these trees and just tear your arm out. Anyway, we're heading out of the jungle on this little tiny, looks like a little bass boat with all of our luggage, everything, and two missionaries. They had to take us out. It was a 10-hour trip, leaving early in the morning because the days are short down there, and traveling, I don't know how many miles, it was 10 hours by boat to a horrible little village. We stayed here in this place. And this is the chef. I went inside to take a picture of the chef cooking dinner. I did not, not only did I not eat the food, I didn't touch the food. I can tell you the health department has not been there to check anything out. I think I don't have a picture. You could see meat hanging outside, right out where people had urinated, feces, everything. Just the meat just hanging there, flies all over it, and horrible. Here's a The only miracle, I've had maybe two or three things I would call miraculous in my life, and this is one of them. It's hard for you to see this, but I'm taking a picture of an 18-year-old kid driving a bus. There's 55 of us on this bus. We get to a place, we're trying to get out. When we finally took the boat to this village, it was a horrible place. There were people running around that had guns and they were all drunk. There were no, you couldn't lock a door, just screen doors if you stayed there. And next morning, we get on this bus with 55 people on it. The capacity was like 30-some. The people had their chickens and their kids hanging all over. There's an 18-year-old kid driving this. We get to a river, and the bridge is washed out. And so this guy is going to take us through that river. You see the car in front? It's, the water is over the top of the hood of that car. And I'm thinking, you've got to be kidding me. I'm on this side over here, and the river's flowing that way. So I thought if it comes over, I'm a goner. You know, I'm going to drown. We get out. You can see how high the water came up over the top of that. That's impossible. You can't take 55 people through a river and have the water come up over the engine. Paul Rill, standing in the front, ran the bus system for the high school in Baltimore County. Baltimore, he ran all the buses. And he told me, he says, that no possible way a bus can go through water if it was nobody on it. And that's what he does for a living. We made it all the way through. 18-year-old kid driving this thing. And I said, that's worth taking a picture of. That is a miracle, because I'm telling you, you're talking about prayer. We were praying. By the way, we no sooner got a bit further, and a picture I don't have, some gorillas pull us over, they have guns, and they just get off the bus. I don't know if they're going to tell us what they're going to do, but I thought they were going to confiscate my camera, which they didn't. But there's some pictures of some people. Here's an old man. This guy was probably well up in his 70s. He's carrying, I don't know, 150 pounds worth of wood in his back for miles and miles and miles. Just to give you an idea how people live. I love that shot. These are Quechua Indians, and they're up in the Andes Mountains. And, you'll notice I'm not in this picture because I'm the one taking it. There's too much work involved here. We were up at a place called Cloud House, where there are rainbows that are just flashing constantly. It's the only place in the world, I think, it's like this. It's very, very windy, and it's very moist. And the sun is beating down. You see rainbows just flashing everywhere, just constantly. Right? It must be a National Geographic somewhere. We went up to the top here in our truck. We ran off. You can't call AA up there. Now I'm heading down to the, now we're with Warren and the gang down to our Bolivia, to our Brazil trip. These are my three girls, my daughters with me, and my son has not been able to go. But if, I can tell you, encourage you something. If you can take your children on a missions trip and get them interested in missions, it really has a tremendous impact on just their view of life back here in the States. Not just going someplace, but actually their own view of life here. They've all been raised in a nice area, and they like life here, but they've all developed a real heart for the people that are down there in the jungle. This is, you remember the blind fellow? I can't remember his name. Warren's been with me on these trips, and this guy walks around with a little harmonica playing Amazing Grace. He's blind. He was taken into this little village. It's a very poor village. There's not very many people in the village. I don't know, maybe 80, 100 people, something like that. That's where you gave your testimony, and you started talking about grace and started crying. And this guy, when he came to the village, he said, because the people there weren't believers at the time, he said, "I'm the only one who's blind, but I'm also the only one who can see," because he had the gospel. And he just walks around just encouraging people. He has nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing. But he's just a delightful guy. I don't recall his name. I had wrestled a huge anaconda and lost. Anyway, here we are. You put this one into the jungle there on this particular trip? Oh, yeah, second. Okay. The first time he went in, this was a tribal group that had fled. It was a sort of a war that had gone on between some tribes. And we'd heard about these people. We'd heard that this particular group had heard the gospel. And so, I don't even know how we found them. I can't remember how it was. We went in. There's no housing. There was no canopy. There was nothing. Just about 15 or 20 of them. They were right in the jungle. And Dr. Kelly brought her guitar. We came in there. And a lady in the yellow is the founder of Ray of Hope Ministries, Gloria. And Milton, right behind her, has always been my guide. He knows the jungle like nobody's business. They actually both do very, very well. We went in there, and they told us about how they had come to the Lord about 3 months prior to that. And in the process of telling us that, I started asking some questions. I just had to find, did they really know the Lord? And every single one of those people could tell you how it had dramatically changed their lives. Marriages were healed. They weren't angry any longer. They couldn't wait to worship. They had no Bible. They knew about prayer, worship. They wanted to reach the other tribal group of people that were down there. They developed a love for one another. It was literally the power of the gospel without anybody teaching any theology. They had the Spirit of God. It was one of the most moving experiences in my life. I have some actual video footage of this too. But then we got on board and went back. It's a great opportunity. Here's what it looks like during the flooding seasons when you go down there. These are two pastors, and they would wade out to help their congregants get into the church in the morning. And people didn't say, "Oh, it's just too hard to get to church today. It's snowing. It's too cold. You know, my Lexus isn't working right." They will come and they'll get out of their little boats and wade in. And the pastor in the stripe on the left there told me, he said, "When you're wading," he said, "make sure you kick things up because you don't want to step on top of a mat or anything." He said, "Once you get stung by one of those babies, you know, you that's going to ruin your day." He said, "Don't just take steps, just, you know, kick things up and stir things up." I can't tell you how excited I was about that. And along with snakes and everything else that's down there. Those are the ones that are on stilts. Many of the houses are not on stilts, and the water just comes right up into the house, into the church. I think I told you guys about the pastor that I met the last time that had killed 20 snakes during the sermon and then killed a 10-foot alligator at the end of the sermon. We haven't had that happen at RBC in a long time. We got here, this little boy had just passed out from starvation, and we just fed him. He hadn't eaten in 4 or 5 days. We brought food in to this poverty-stricken village. This is Peru, Peru, I think that's, yeah. So this little kid, Megan came in, just saw him, and and just fell in love with this little guy. We fed him, got him nourished, got him back on his feet again. When you go to some of these places, I'm sure many of you have traveled, you've seen, you know, difficult places in the world, but some of the poverty and some of the things we've seen here has just been literally overwhelming. That's where we have a speedboat we take to get way back, and you can see we're moving. Here, flying back. This is the sunset of beautiful places down there, beautiful sunsets, beautiful and joyful people that you'll also meet down there. Me and Katie, this little girl here, had she been in the States, they could have fixed those eyes in no time at all. Very simple operation, but she'll be like that all her life. Ed Lee, who travels with us, who's a ear, nose, and throat specialist, said that if you don't get this done, you know, if they took her back to the States at this age, apparently it's traumatic for your eyes to get fixed. It does something, your brain's not used to it, and it traumatizes you. So you have to do it very, very early, or you can't do it. I'm not sure I understand all that, that's how it works. This is the picture of me and the pastor that bought our other church. I'm passing the keys over to him. And it's just sort of a like a end of a missions journey here, because this guy came from Bolivia. He had a 10,000 member church. He's a powerful pastor down there and is now preaching the gospel. I think he's really growing. Here's just a picture of one of the tribal guys down there that had just heard the gospel, and I'm reminded of that passage, how beautiful are the feet of those that bring the gospel of peace. I wanted to just run that by you because missions to me is the heartbeat. When you think of the last words of Jesus, he says, go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. Or you think about how should they hear without a preacher? I know that one of the most difficult things in Christian life for anybody to grasp or accept or even believe is that people without Christ are lost. People that have not heard the gospel are lost. It may not seem fair, it may not seem right, but it is true. The Bible is quite clear. Only by Christ can a person come into everlasting life. And there are several, or at least 2 billion people that aren't even within the reach of somebody getting to them. So missions is really, really important. And it isn't just here, it's all over the world. A couple of things. Another place I went, which I don't have any pictures of, is I took a trip to Russia back in 1990 or so, somewhere with Prison Fellowship. And that was one of the most heart-wrenching trips I've ever taken in my life. I was with Prison Fellowship, and I was with a fellow named Ron Nickel, who has visited more prisons than anybody in the world. He's been to 690-some prisons, at least at that time, around the world. And when we got to Russia, we went into Moscow, and outside of Moscow is a prison that was built by Catherine the Great back in the 1750s or something like that. And when we got there, some of you have heard me tell some of these stories, when we got there, we were going to take a tour of the prison. I've been to some of the prisons here. You know, we have the volleyball courts, and we've got a place where you can go get a Coke machine, and they have shops and places to read and libraries, and you go back to your cell later on. That ain't the way it is down there. I went down there, and the superintendent called us into his office, and he said, now, those of you that are from the United States, I'm here to tell you, this is going to be traumatic, mentally, emotionally traumatic for some of you. So I want you to be braced and aware of what you're going to be seeing. This is not like what you have in the United States. We don't have the money here, and this prison only is supposed to house 5,000 people. We have 8,500 here. 3,500 more than we're supposed to have. Most of the people that were there had done things like steal a loaf of bread. And they were in there for 5 years. They just get them off the streets and put them in there. So we go in, and we're starting to walk to an ancient old place, and there's water dripping down, 60-watt bulbs hanging through these wires, bare wires, and I'm walking along, and I see these casings. They look like a coffin standing up. And that's where they put people that are waiting to go in. You know, it's locking these like little coffins standing up. Just awful. Finally got into the prison, in the area where the cells were, and I noticed the prison doors were just, they didn't have any bars, it was solid steel doors with a little tiny opening, you could slide, and you'd stick your cup out, and they'd pour some slop in there, and that was your food for the day. Well, they allowed us to go in. They said, okay, you can go in, and they opened up the doors, and as soon as I went in, I noticed the room, you probably heard me tell this story, the room of the actual cell was about the size of a racquetball court. Y'all know what that looks like. Roughly about half the size of this little section over here. And there were about 70 men in there, in the side of a racquetball court. And many of them had tuberculosis, and just they were sitting there dying. And a few bunks, they just slept wherever they could sleep, standing up, falling all over each other. There was one toilet, a little bit of water, a dripping sink, and a 60-watt bulb. With 70 guys inside of a racquetball court. And I'm walking in there, and the stench was unbelievable. I couldn't speak Russian, obviously, but I had people with me. I just asked them a few questions. And then later on, I walked out, and I turned to the guard, and I said, this is just inhumane. I said, living there. And then I saw a whole bunch of guys coming down the hallway. I said, who are these guys? They said, those are the guys on the workforce. That's another 70 that are going into that same cell. 140, 150 guys inside of a racquetball court. You imagine that? And they're going to die. They're going to die. You get one meal a day. But here was something that was so beautiful. We took a trip. There was some people from Navigators that took us down into the place where they were, the people that were on death row were. These guys are just going to die in their cells unless they get out in a few years. But we went down to death row. And in death row, if you're sitting inside your cell and you hear a key go and open up the door, you're pretty sure it's either somebody's here to visit you for something because they just slide food in, or you're being taken out to be killed. And what they do is they take you out, and they don't notify any of your relatives. They just shoot you in the back of the head, and you fall into a pit, and they close it up, and there's no grave, and there's no grave. That's how they do it. Well, we were down there, and the Navigator guys took us in, and they opened up the cell, and these guys were sitting in there reading the Navigator guide on eternal security, where I can't remember what it was.
Lessons on assurance.
Every single one of the 8,500 men had been given the gospel to them. Every single one. The guy that was there was from Chicago, and he said, it was hard getting into the prisons in Chicago. Why don't I go where it's like shooting fish in a barrel? He said, everything, let me have the whole run of the place. And many of them come to Christ. So I thought, isn't it interesting? Here are people sitting in a horrible situation that know the Lord, and here are people in the United States, like maybe a Donald Trump, and they've never even heard a clear presentation of the gospel. Too wrapped up in building kingdoms, and these people die and be in heaven, and they may not be unless somebody gets to soon. So it was traumatic, I must tell you. It was traumatic. Just seeing what was taking place there was hard to get my arms, hard to get a grip on. We went to some other prisons too and saw some things over in Latvia and Estonia. Some of the little Baltic states there was really really difficult. But to know that the gospel is going out, that there are people that are carrying the gospel, like Navigators, the Campus Crusade, others reaching out all around the world is tremendous. Another place I went one time was Guatemala, I guess probably 12, 13 years ago. A lady in our church, she's attending our church here, she's since moved, but she had a relative who was a pastor down there, and he had set up an orphanage in Guatemala, a very, very difficult place. And he invited me to come down and speak for about a week. And I got down there, and this guy had the most amazing story of how he had gotten there and built, he had a walled orphanage. There was no way to get in inside this place, just walled off. And he took all these orphans off the street, and he fed them, he clothed them, he taught them how to use computers, how to work on how to do carpentry work and sew. All the girls were dressed beautifully, you know, very modestly, and all the guys, I mean, they went to class every day, they were learning theology, they were being taught everything in the scriptures. And this was a large orphanage, a lot of kids. And they asked me to speak, and the first day I got there, they do a lot of worship beforehand. I mean, a lot of worship. And so we're all in the back, and it's a little bit of a Pentecostal kind of a orphanage. When they get to singing, they do this little hopping thing. They do this. So I'm up on the stage, and I'm doing this little thing like this. Well, they're waiting for me to tell them what I'm going to speak. I didn't know that. I was supposed to speak at 8 o'clock. I didn't get in to the pulpit until 11:30. 3.5 hours of doing this, of singing and dancing, 3.5 hours. I thought, whoa! So eventually the worship leader said, hey, what are you? I said, I'm waiting for you. He goes, I'm waiting for you. So my legs are not enough. So I did it for the rest of the week. Just sing about 5 songs and get up there and preach. Then I preach in their service, and they had a large auditorium. It was a very large church. And I preached for about 45 minutes. And when I was finished, Pat again said, we didn't come here to leave. Keep going. We'll stand here all day. We're not going anywhere. Why are you in a hurry? What's this 45 minutes about? What's like over here? When's he going to get out of there? The culture in so many different places is just so different as to how we see things. But even in that particular setting, they had, in order to protect these kids, they had watchdogs. They had these German shepherds that they let out at 9 o'clock at night. They were supposed to ever be outside beyond 9 o'clock. And they brought them back in at about 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning. And I had told the students, there were volcanoes around. I said, I really want to see an active volcano. They hadn't seen one in a long time. Well, one went off real early in the morning. And they said, they called me. They said, Pastor Mike, you've got an active volcano. I forgot about these dogs. Anyway, they brought the dogs in. And I saw this volcano erupting. And they literally thought I must have had some amazing power. Because I literally prayed that I'd be able to see a volcano erupt. I hadn't seen one in a long time. So I definitely had your attention. No. But it was interesting because here's a guy that came from the States, went down there with his wife, and started this orphanage, and now there are hundreds and hundreds of kids that have taken off the street, given the gospel, trained, and are now going back into the workplace. Lives dramatically changed, just dramatically changed because of one man and his wife that went down to do that. So missions is big, but I will tell you this, missions is not... It's never been terribly popular, no matter where you go in the United States. If I said this morning, if Alex put out a message saying that Mike's going to speak on how to overcome depression, you probably couldn't have gotten in. By the way, the church attendance went way up this past week, because the week before, I said, I'm going to talk about how Satan attacks your heart, your mind, your conscience, your emotions. We had about 150 more people this week than we had the week before. People are interested in things regarding themselves. As soon as you start talking about missions, I'm just here to tell you, when we have our kickoff on Wednesday at Missions Conference, I plead, beg, do backflips, please come out, fill the auditorium. We usually have about 150, 180 people to come. That includes the missionaries and their families. That includes all of our youth group. That includes the elders and their wives. That includes our staff. You remove that, you've got about 50 people out of 3,000 to come out and kick off. This is really not a mission-minded church. It's a leadership mission-minded church. But getting people interested, and it's not a rebuke, it's just a truth. People are interested in what's going on here. When you start talking about something going on over there, we just look interested. It took me a long time to get interested in missions. The first time I knew anything about missions was from John Fletcher at Faith Bible Church. When I first came here, church got started. He said, what are you doing for missions? I said, I don't even know what missions is. He said, come to one of our conferences. And I went, and I started seeing what was going on. Then I took a trip, and once I saw what the world looked like and all that we had here, not just in material possessions, but the gospel and the truth and the Bible, I got a heart to see that this world is reached with the gospel. But getting people excited about it is a hard thing to do. It's very, very hard. And I don't blame anybody. It's just part of our culture. We're wrapped up in our own problems, our own things. If you take a trip sometime, and you see what this world looks like, and you see what people are going through, and you see people have any hope, It'll change your life. So I'll leave you with the fact that Jesus' last command was to go into all the world. And Paul's admonition is, how are they going to believe unless someone tells them? How are they going to believe unless someone is sent? How beautiful are the feet of those that preach the gospel of peace and bring glad tidings. So I think we have some questions. Some stuff?
Sorry. Yeah, I was going to ask, if anybody had any questions for Mike, I'd like to start with one.
Sure.
What can we do? That's a good question. What is our role? So, you know, I mentioned that we're a leadership mission-minded church. If you need not knowing that we're engaged, what's our, you know, we get the church
Yeah.
It's a good portion of the budget, about 40%, 40%.
About 40%.
Okay, significant. How many challenges is that, what are the things that we'd be doing, thinking about, besides giving, how would we?
Take a trip.
Be involved.
Take a trip, go on a mission trip. How many have you been on?
One.
About 11 trips, you've been to a lot of different places. That probably impacts you more than anything else. Actually getting out of the comfort zone, going someplace, seeing what it looks like, other parts of the world. I would say just pray and ask God to give you heart for it. It isn't going to come naturally. We don't think that way. I don't think that way. I'm selfish. I like my life. I like my comfort. I like all that. My daughter Katie, all my kids have been changed, but I would say my daughter Katie the most. She wouldn't mind telling me she likes nice things. She's a real beautiful blonde. Her husband makes good money and she can afford stuff. And about the third trip down there, when she was on her way back and landed in Atlanta and saw all the stuff, you know, duty free, this and jewelry, she got physically ill. She says, I'm done with material stuff. I hate it. I just hate it. And she came back and said, We're gonna start living our lives for missions. I think she and Brad may go down there and live for 6 months at some time. She's trying to adopt a little girl from down there, but that's never gonna happen. But it'll impact your life.
Once. I was talking to Scott Ellen. He has Genesis Landscape, and we were just sitting together talking about missions, and he said he felt like God has put all of us here and was the richest county in the country and the richest country in the world. And that one of our roles here, if you have a business or if you have good income, is to really give. You know, yeah. One of our roles might be just to really pump money into missions because God's blessed us.
Yeah.
You may not have the time with your business to go. Maybe it doesn't work for you, but one thing you can do is give.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's just giving what you give on Sunday to a local church. I think you can support. If you can support missionaries yourself, that's a whole different avenue through your business.
Yeah.
It's just a wonderful thing to do about life.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, you and his wife and I both are really involved and help purchase a tractor for us down there. Hyundai, usually emails me once a week or calls me once a week. And what's going on? What's happening? I'm just so excited to see that she's excited and they're excited about this. Because you all haven't even been Christians that long. You came to the Lord here at RBC, if I'm not mistaken, about 4 or 5 years ago. Six years ago, okay. And got just excited about mission. So
Hyundai is always excited.
Yeah, she is. That doesn't take too much to get the introvert and the extroverts, I assume. That's
true.
Both doctors, by the way.
Mike, I just want to take this opportunity to do a commercial. So I could not agree more to go to the field, but not all of us can go.
Yeah.
But we have resources. I challenge us to put aside a substantial purchase and give that money to the designated missionary that RBC supports. And your heart will go where the money is. And Mike, you couldn't do this better. You will be concerned, you will be calling, you will be following up. You will know where your money is and what the money is doing. And at the end of 1 year, you'll be glad to do that. So anyway, there are a number of missionaries that RBC support. They are currently on sabbatical or on a furlough. RBC has more or less maxed out, not because we don't have the money, but with our policy, we have given them the most we can possibly give under our policy. But they are still underfunded. They are delayed their furlough to go back to the field, and they are aching, and they are bleeding, and they are crying. So if any of us has that money to set aside, talk to Bill Hurley, talk to the mission board, we will help you find a missionary that is ready to go back but doesn't have the money. And you can make a difference.
Yeah.
If it's an orphanage somewhere, there's a college somewhere, there is a prison somewhere that is waiting for this person to come back.
Yeah. There's a commercial from the missions committee right there. Okay. Anybody else? Yeah.
Oh, it's not just a sidebar comment. I was thinking that here we are, wonder about the atrocities that happened in the blocks of bullets where all the other kids. They don't have, I mean, they don't have God at all in that place. They don't think of themselves. You know, maybe there might be a project where somebody or some groups get involved in to encourage a bigger way that Bibles can be brought back in these people's bread. So is that, that to me is an atrocity. That is a disgrace.
Yeah, but is that a person see that? That's a battle. That's a hard battle going over.
Well, individuals, right? Sometimes it was boxes, passages, for literature's sake, but for a teacher, say, Scott Russell here, open it for 5 minutes of Catholic class, and he said that that would be good.
How would you answer someone? If I could work out the logistics of them going to Africa in some kind of Zimbabwe, I was talking to a friend of mine at a regular church door yesterday, and he said, why would you go to Africa on a mission trip when there's so many people here in the United States that you could preach to? You'd go to West Virginia or Alabama or Maine. You know, why would you go all the way there when there's people right here that's within 100 miles of you? And he said, he always felt it was more self-fulfilling for an American to go to those places and preach those people that are poor, like the pictures you have, and then come back to America and go back to the American lifestyle. So, how would I answer somebody that, why are we going there when we have so many people here in the United States?
To hear the gospel?
Right.
Yeah, I would say the answer is almost everybody here at least has a chance to hear the gospel. Many people that have no chance. There's no radio. They make it turn the radio on here. Now, that doesn't mean you're necessarily going to get up one morning and go, I think I'll tune in to hear a good, clear presentation of the gospel. You don't know what that is. But you've heard it. You've seen a Bible. You've heard it. You know their arguments about Christianity. You have to live in the way backwoods in the United States not to know something about Jesus Christ. Whereas you go to some parts of the world, they've never heard the name. They have no idea who Jesus is. That's the reason that Jesus said, go into all the world. And plus, that's what he told us to do. By the way, there are people now leaving those countries and coming here to preach the gospel. That's how far we've come. How far we've gone. We actually have people from other parts of the world that are coming here to think we're so far gone as a secular society. So,
and sometimes, too, if you go on a trip, you come back. It's so joyful to see people so little that are really happy and have joy that we don't see there. I mean, if you go to Fiji Bible College, you can see those students. They're the happiest people I've ever been around.
Yeah.
And they have nothing. And you just come back with a different perspective on your stuff.
You really do. Yeah, you really do. Okay. Say, my time to dive in. Paul.
I'd like to hear Warren's perspective with it. Guy running a big driving business, and how he got involved with the mission trips originally, and what got going into that.
How
did you get started in that? I mean, you've been busy with the restoration.
My dad, who had his architectural practice. I mean, we had devotions every morning. Missions was big to him. I mean, he liked to give the missions. I think he just taught us as children that was really important. And then as our business grew, we got to a point where, if you could graph things, we could see our business really take off. We got to a point where we said, we're going to take a certain percentage, say, this is God's money, and say, this is his. And we just started supporting missionaries out of our business. I mean, finding missionaries that God would bring across our radar screen and just support them. And we got to a point where really we were supporting as many missionaries as a lot of small churches. And you can see God just kind of, the blessing just in our business just take off. We said, we can trust you with that. But it's just, like, when you go and you see firsthand what God's doing, it's so rewarding.
So. Warren's we've traveled 4 times the other night. He has to put up with my snoring. With the outside of that, and he's filmed some of the things.
I was laughing. You're talking about your experience with dogs on another trip, and I was thinking of our last trip and the dogs on the barn. You went upstairs to use facilities. You don't run back upstairs.
What is that? I thought they're on board. Okay, let's go to the questions here and dive in.